We know it's cold outside. Are you worried about your heating bill this month? Not Urbana homeowner Suja Thomas.
It's 74 degrees in the house, and we don't have any heat on. And earlier in the week, it was negative 11, and we didn't have any heat on in the house.
We find out more about her specially designed passive house. Northwestern University's Vicky Calogera leads a team of astrophysicists who look for gravitational waves from black holes with a new kind of telescope called LIGO.
Up until then, we had no experimental or observational evidence that pairs of black holes existed anywhere in nature.
The astrophysicist they're speaking to Northwestern University just won a national award for her research. And Twitter has adopted new policies against hate symbols, abuse, and harassment in order to make the platform feel safer. But how will it be enforced? And who defines hate on social media? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone has a warm place to shelter today here in Urbana. I think we're forecast to reach a high of 17. It is not that warm right now. Oh, it's 5 degrees outside right now. 2 weeks ago, when it was around these temperatures, I noticed a Facebook post from University of Illinois law professor Suja Thomas. It was about how it was well below zero, but it was 75 inside her house, and she hadn't even turned on her heat yet. That's because she lives in what's called a passive house. It's especially built not to need external heating or cooling systems. And the passive home movement that actually began in the U.S. with hundreds of projects right now started right here in Urbana. I went over to her house for her to give me a tour.
Hi, I'm Suja Thomas, and yeah, this is my passive house here in Urbana-Champaign. It's 74 degrees in the house, and we don't have any heat on in the house. And earlier in the week, it was negative 11, and we didn't have any heat on in the house. We've never had temperatures like this, so it was a nice, really nice test for the house that you could even get to negative 11, and I know it was even lower than that, and we had no heat on.
We're standing in front of a really big window, which to my mind would think, oh, this is not going to keep the house warm.
Right. So oftentimes we think of windows as, you know, releasing air and as a result not efficient. But these are very special windows. These are triple glazed windows. And these windows actually allow the sun to heat the house. But it also doesn't permit air to escape easily. You don't really use that much of your house. We kind of noticed that when we had bigger houses. And so kind of the main area is the kitchen and the living room area. And this is kind of the area that where we entertain. So it's worked out really well for us. The house is only 830 square feet, but we can have parties with 30 people in this house. I mean, I think that a lot of us think about the environment and a lot of what we do, whether it be our living in our house or going to work in our cars, those are big contributors for us as individuals. And so if you as an individual want to actually do something for the environment, two of the things that you can do something for the environment with are your car and where you live. It's really great to live in a place where you say to yourself, oh, you know, I'm doing what I can do to help the environment.
Thanks to 21st producers Robin Lynn and Alan Montesilio for producing that. And Suja Thomas is actually in studio with me now. Hi, Suja. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
On the line with us from Chicago is the executive director of the Passive House Institute U.S. She's also the architect who designed Suja's house, Katrine Kleinenberg. Katrine, welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So you've designed, Katrine, you started with 7 homes in Illinois. What does the movement look like now throughout the U.S.?
Well, it has been very impressive over the last couple of years. As you mentioned, we started initially with 7 houses in Illinois, and at that point we were still doing design build. And soon thereafter, there were articles written, and we had a lot of interest nationwide, actually, about what we were doing. We started putting together a curriculum and to train architects and engineers and builders how to build these houses. And from these initial training classes, a lot of projects were built around the country, single-family homes at first, But most recently, we also see a lot of interest in the multifamily, especially affordable sector. And now, about, I'd say, 10 years later, we have a little more than 700 projects in the pipeline around the country.
Suja, can I ask, so you don't really have a heating or cooling bill, really, to speak of per month, right? When you're thinking about how much, when we're thinking about the cost of this, obviously we'll get to the kind of the build costs, but your upkeep costs of this are really low, right?
They're really low. We sometimes turn on an external source of heat, baseboard heaters or our heat pump. But on many days, we don't have any external heat on. And there are probably some people who live in Urbana who probably could live in our house without heat on. We tend to like it a little hot. And so if it tends to be in the, 60s, we want to put some heat on.
And so we mentioned the windows. Your house has 15 inches of insulation on all sides. Does that make it really quiet inside as well?
It is. It's extremely quiet in the house.
And Katrine, why is it important to have that insulation? The house also sits on this huge styrofoam foundation. Is that considered part of the insulation as well?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the most important strategies that you want to employ building a passive house is to have a continuous thick layer of insulation. And that includes the slab or the floor, right? Because it touches the ground. Initially, you would think that that warms up the ground, warms up your slab or your floor, but it doesn't because it's always year-round at about like 50 degrees, and you would always lose heat to the ground. So having a nice big insulation cushion under your slab or floor plate really helps with the comfort of the house.
And there's a few other hallmarks of these. We mentioned and we heard Suja talking about the windows and the special insulation, sort of the specially designed windows and doors. How do you improve? I didn't realize, talking to you about this earlier, I didn't realize lots of homes have a lot of gaps in them. And that's probably a big way we lose a lot of heating and cooling throughout a home, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you ask the Department of Energy or like the energy experts around the country, some crazy numbers of like how many lineal feet of gaps are actually in existing homes. Like they are very, very leaky. And if you have all these gaps in your envelope, and including the windows are not built very well to be airtight. You lose a lot of energy through these gaps and leaks, and also it makes the building uncomfortable. So yeah. Stop those leaks, and you just increase your comfort even more.
And then there's also a mechanical system. How does that ensure that there's always fresh air circulating in the house?
Yeah, so the we call it the fresh air system. There is a small mechanical system still that we want and need because we want to exchange air. We want to always have fresh air. We want to have filtered air. And by having that mechanical system that brings in fresh air, we also have the opportunity to recover the heat from it. There's a heat exchange core in it, and the incoming airstream passes by the outgoing airstream. We throw out the pollutants, the moisture, and all the VOCs that we don't want in the home. We bring in fresh air, but the energy that we just produced inside of our home, we want to recycle that back into the incoming airstream, and that's what this little machine does for us. And it runs at very low flows. It's not like a forced air system. It doesn't move around dust at all. It's always fresh filtered air. And so you don't really notice it at all, but you have fresh air 24/7 all the time.
And Suja, and so inside the house, it is like, it's not like stale air. It's not forced air. It's not dry either, right? Whether
no.
It's the winter or the summer, it's kind of the same year round.
Oh, right, right. It's perfectly comfortable air in the house, yeah.
Right. And so Suja, you deliberately decided that you built this house from the ground up, and you decided you wanted a small footprint for this house to begin with.
Yeah, both my husband and I had bigger houses in the past, and we realized that the space that most people use is the kitchen and the living room area, and we actually like to have parties, and we've had plenty of kind of parties with lots of people, but we use that area, and so, we thought that, we could put less money into the house and put resources into other types of things.
Katrine, how expensive is it to build a house like this? I imagine for a single family unit, this can be much more expensive than if you're doing a new construction that's multifamily, right?
Yeah, so when we first started, the additional upfront cost, of course, that always comes up. And because you use more insulation and you pay more attention to details, there's initially more effort that goes into the planning of the house. And to meet such a tight energy budget, you also want to make sure you have an expert on the team that can calculate your energy balance so that your house will actually perform the way Suja has described. It's really fantastic that they don't have to turn the heat on, right, on a very cold day. So there's some additional costs. We have been able to come in on smaller homes like hers, like I'd say plus or minus 10%, 15% or so. But unfortunately, you're still looking for single-family homes because it's not widespread technology. You're looking at custom design. And custom design is always more expensive. There are no modular homes just yet that when they produce 100 or 200 homes, right, then they can really bring the cost down. But unfortunately, it's not that far in the market yet developed that we have that available. So you'll be looking at a custom home. But when you go into multifamily building design, which we're seeing a lot now, we even see high-rises go up in New York City, at that point, the cost comes down dramatically. And we've seen 100-unit buildings now in New York completed at 0% additional cost, so 0 to like 1%. And that's fantastic, right? At that point, that's what we want to see.
So, Suja, you had the idea a couple years ago or when you moved to Urbana that you wanted to build this house. Have you ever regretted it? Or especially a winter like this, I think you're probably pretty happy with why you guys chose to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, my husband and I bought a lot in Chicago recently, and we already started thinking about what type of eco build we would do. And we're convinced that, you know, we're going to do a passive house again.
So for people who might be more interested in this, what advice would you give them, Suja?
Well, for sure, look at Katrine's website, and you can Google Passive House and get great New York Times articles that give information about other houses that have been built. Of course, if anyone here in the area is interested in taking a look at our house, we're happy to show it to them. And I'm sure Katrine is happy to talk to people who are interested.
Right. And Katrine, there's for folks in the Urbana area, that note for Suja Thomas. And then, Katrine, you have houses all across Illinois that you've been involved with as well. We have at our website, we have pictures of Suja's house as well as links to the Passive House Institute US. But I want to thank both of you, Katrine Kleinenberg and Suja Thomas, for being with me. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
As we mentioned, this difficult winter does mean higher heating bills, as we've been talking about. And for people who are already struggling to make ends meet, that means for many of our most vulnerable and low-income residents, next month they may have to choose between paying a utility bill or buying groceries. So we thought we'd check in with Rock River Valley Pantry. They're based in Rockford. Its executive director, Kim Adams-Bakke, joins us now. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the 21st.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Kim, when you think about this time of year, do you worry about people with your population that you serve next month having to choose between energy bills and food costs?
Well, yes, we do. And we anticipate we will see a slight increase in the percentage of people that need our services come February when the January bills do roll in.
How much does cold weather make it harder for some people to access to, I guess, first of all, how many people need your services?
Rock River Valley Pantry assists about 6,500 individuals on a monthly basis.
And in the winter, do you find that number changes?
It does. February, we actually decline a little bit, and we attribute that to the harshness of the winter. And we always see a spike in the summer months when kids are out of school, and we actually will assist about 7,200 individuals when the public school systems are out for summer break.
What do you do, Kim, to make sure that the weather doesn't get in the way of people getting access to food?
Well, we have a plan in place. One thing is we're very reliant upon our volunteers, and we have a tremendous volunteer corps. There's about 100 a week that assist us in distributing food. And we have tremendous commitment on their part. And if they can't get here, we have a pool of other volunteers that we call, and they come in to help make sure the food is distributed. We work closely with the local grocers as part of the food rescue program that we have. And we are out collecting perishable food and bringing it back into the pantry for the clients to select from. And so the stores know we're coming, and our driver and the volunteer that go out on a daily basis are ready for the weather elements, whichever they may be, in order to bring that food back. We also open our door early. Nobody wants to stand outside in the cold. And so we'll open our lobby up a little bit earlier for the clients, as well as allow them to wait for rides that they may be in waiting for.
Kim, how does this winter compare to previous years?
Oh, you know, when you're in the midst of it, it always seems like it's the worst winter ever. But right now we are seeing just a small decline in attendance, and that was on the days that we had the sub-zero wind chill. Client utilization was down about 20%. And then yesterday in the Rockford area, we had, I think, slightly over 4 inches of snow. And our attendance yesterday was actually down 50% than what we normally see. So today it's a little bit sunnier, the roads are clear, and we anticipate we'll make up for that today.
Right. So a little peek into how the weather affects not just access to your services, but need at Rock River Valley Pantry in Rockford. Kim, thank you so much. Just quick question. Do you need volunteers? What do you need this time of year?
We are always in need of volunteers. We do have some volunteers that are winter birds, and they go south and they go west, so we can always use volunteers. An easy thing for everybody to accumulate and donate is plastic and paper grocery bags. We use between 300 and 400 bags a day, and we would rather buy food than buy bags. And then, of course, just support.
Thanks for that. That's Kim Adams-Bakke. She's Executive Director of Rock River Valley Pantry in Rockford. Thanks for being with me, Kim.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. Yesterday was our holiday to honor the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Today marks the second annual National Day of Racial Healing. One of the ways you might heal may be to take a little break from social media, where the rhetoric can sometimes be hateful. Twitter, for one, has taken some recent steps to try to change that. But how effective will these changes be, and how do you police users' hate speech when lots of people might be breaking the rules, including maybe even our president? Joining me to talk about Twitter's new policies is University of Illinois law professor Jason Mazzoni. He directs Constitutional Theory, History, and Law program at the university. Returning to the program is April Glazer, a technology journalist for Slate. She's on the line from San Francisco. April, Jason, thanks for being here.
Thank you. So good
much.
Morning.
Morning. April, why don't we start with what Twitter has changed in an effort to make it, quote, a safer place. Can you walk through the plan that culminated last week?
Last week? No, this actually came into effect at the middle of December.
Right. Sorry, that finished. I think there was in a couple phases that ended, that were completed last week, if I'm correct.
Sure. Yeah, it's been rolled out slowly, really since November they've been looking at this. But basically, Twitter has decided or had rolled out a number of changes that kind of bar users who take to the platform to promote what they say violence against civilians, to further their causes. They also no longer allow content that glorifies violence on the platform. They also bar, users that attack other people that on the basis of their characteristics, so like of a certain group, so like their race or religion. As well as any users that harass people into silence. They've also you know, banned a number of hate speech symbols, and are really just being much more aggressive about fostering, you know, a community that is going to make people feel safe and not attacked.
April, do we have a sense of who's doing the monitoring? I know, for example, Facebook has come under fire for having bots sometimes doing monitoring, and that hasn't worked out super great. How is Twitter doing this?
You know, Twitter has not shared too much about their monitoring team, but they certainly have a mix of, you know, AI that, you know, are seeing when are looking for, you know, particularly problematic words or content or phrases. But they're relying a lot on self-reporting. So they have, like, you know, a full kind of repository center where people can say that, you know, a certain tweet was, you know, threatening them or you know, saying negative things about an entire group of people based on their characteristics. And you can report those. And Twitter has taken a lot of steps to respond very quickly. You know, it's a mix of people and machine learning and, you know, algorithms and things like that. But they're not lifting the hood too much and letting us know what's happening there, probably to avoid a lot of the negative press that Facebook got. So Facebook, you know, resorted to bots after it was revealed that they had, you know, a group of people, independent contractors, that were doing a lot, making a lot of the judgment calls that were, you know, deemed to be unfair to conservative users.
And this gets really squishy, right? Jason, is there a legal definition in the U.S. of what hate speech is?
No. So I teach constitutional law. And so as a matter of constitutional law, there just is no concept of hate speech. And I think so this is maybe one important thing to note at the outset, that Twitter is, of course, a private corporation. And so it's perfectly free to have whatever speech rules that it wants, perfectly free to impose those upon users and to remove posts that it doesn't like or run afoul of its policies or close accounts, which is done in some cases. And so what we're dependent upon really is the corporation Twitter's own sort of sense or definition of what hate speech is, or what they actually refer to as hateful conduct. And I was just looking at the Twitter rules, and so here's how they describe it. You may not promote violence against, threaten, or harass other people on the basis of race, ethnicity, national origin, sexual orientation, gender identity, religious affiliation, age, disability, or serious disease. So this goes to the point of being this much more expansive list than they had previously, in addition to beefed up enforcement mechanisms. But we really don't know at the end of the day what it is that counts as quote unquote hate speech. It's not a legal concept. It's a concept that has some popular resonance, but that is really dependent upon the enforcers, whoever they are, at Twitter, to make these kinds of determinations. And there, you know, you run into sort of the obvious question: what are the standards? How much training goes into teaching people who are going to be reviewing these kinds of reports that they get? What sort of parameters or what's built into the algorithm to identify hate speech? And at the end of the day, who is getting suspended or having to delete posts and so on? And Twitter has been, quite circumspect about exactly what these concepts mean. There have been various media requests asking Twitter, you know, tell us, give us more details, provide us with the training manual so that we have a sense of what it is that you're going after. And Twitter's response has been, no, we don't want to do that. We don't want to do that. I suspect in part because they're still working on it, but we don't want to do that because we don't want people to be able to evade the rules if they know what they are. So here again, the difference between Twitter being a private corporation and being a government, we never tolerate the government saying we're not going to tell you what the rules are, because then you might be able to comply with them. But Twitter is free to do this. And I think we just have to sort of wait and see what happens, who's targeted and so on. There were, immediately after these rules were rolled out, targeting of certain right-wing organizations in this country, the Traditionalist Workers' Party, white nationalist group Vanguard America, they had their accounts suspended. So at least you get some evidence of the kind of people that they're going after. But I think we just have to kind of wait and see, you know, who is removed, who's not removed, whether those people are going to speak out and identify that they have been targeted.
Right. And so when you think about that, April, in particular, people being targeted, last year, Twitter was under fire so verification is a blue check mark symbol. It means that an account is verified. Late last year, Twitter was under fire because they were verifying the white nationalist Jason Kessler. They also previously had verified people like Mike Cernowich, who fueled the whole Pizzagate controversy, and then they stopped verifying people for a while. Why? What's so important about verifications, April, in this process as well, and where do they stand with that right now?
Right, and so, I mean, what you're pointing to is this roller coaster, and a lot of that has to do with just the massive inconsistency with Twitter's kind of enforcement of the rules on its platform. But you're right. They verified Jason Kessler, who was one of the organizers of the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. That got a huge public backlash saying, you know, why are you verifying somebody who is essentially famous for being, you know, racist or for, you know, being a white nationalist. That verification was then revoked, and then Twitter took the steps to also revoke the verification of other people who were famous on the basis of their bigotry. So Richard Spencer then lost his verification. Now, verification is important because it's not just a blue check mark on the side of your name. It's like kind of being in an elite club that kind of guarantees that you're more likely to be seen, and your tweets and your videos and your content are more likely to be seen than just a regular user.
Right, and I should say,
so
we're
more likely to populate to the top of the page.
And we're verified. Journalists are verified. I'm verified. That's another part of it too, right? Because you can also...
Yes. And so you can not pretend to be someone else. So for instance, the verified real Donald Trump, you know, sets him apart. So, you know, that's who he is. And not if you go to actual Donald Trump, which is another Twitter handle, that's not Donald Trump. Right. And so that verification really matters when you have, you know, important world leaders that are making national statements using Twitter. You know, you need to know that this is actually who they say they are, not some avatar.
Well, and as we think about that, I think that does bring us a little bit to the elephant in this digital room, right? Because when you mention our president, I'm sure there are people listening right now who may be thinking some of the things he says in tweets could be in violation of these guidelines. Can you imagine a possibility where the president would be put on notice for a hate tweet?
Well, so remember, this Twitter has already confronted this issue at the end of last year. There was a push to have Twitter do something about President Trump's account, maybe suspended or require him to remove tweets or, you know, close account entirely based upon threats he was making against North Korea at the time, saying you're not going to be around much longer. And so if you read, you know, the Twitter ban on violence, you say, well, that sounds like violence. It's a bit of an odd argument because the thing that distinguishes the president from ordinary people is that the president is lawfully allowed to engage in violence. We call it national security and waging war. And Twitter's response, I think, not surprisingly, was we're not going to deactivate the account of the sitting president based on this. So I think there is some sense that different sorts of rules are going to apply in that context. It makes perfect business sense. I think that the sort of backlash against Twitter for kicking off the president would be tremendous and something that Twitter probably doesn't want to confront.
Right, April, I don't imagine you would ever see that as a possibility.
No, I think it's kind of a liberal fantasy, to be honest with you. You know, when Trump did tweet that video, that doctored video of, you know, someone that had like the face of a CNN TV being crashed to the ground in a wrestling video, you know, that could be seen as violent imagery. But he is the president of the United States, and he's using this as a platform to talk about national security. And you know, honestly, he might tweet himself into his own mess. But I think that revoking his platform is just, you know, not going to happen. It's not feasible, nor is it really worth a campaign.
Well, in April, that also would go against Twitter's sort of culture of Twitter's always kind of been known as the Wild West of social media, which The producers and I were talking this morning about how Twitter took a lot of pains during the Arab Spring to point out how open a platform it was for anyone to post. Certainly, it's a social media platform that took a lot longer, for example, to run ads. And Facebook, they're still trying to figure out how to monetize it. Do you think a regulation on this is something that users want, April?
I think that a regulation on part of it is, you know. I think, you know, they're not trying to make, you know, Twitter some, like, closely guarded playground where nobody can have any fun anymore or make jokes at other people's expense. That's not what's going on here. It's a matter of, you know, stopping jokes, not just jokes, but, like, really, like, harmful speech about, you know, threatening groups of people based on the fact that they're women or on the fact that they're Jewish, you know, or on the fact that, you know, they're from a Muslim-majority country, right? And making sure that that content, you know, is not reaching users, especially if that content, like I said, is actually threatening people. Now, Twitter used to really pride itself on being this kind of Wild West, but that included really not having enough rules to make sure that people could use the platform safely. People have been speaking out against this for a long time. Twitter's been acting very inconsistently, and they're just trying to be consistent about that. You know, they're not trying to stop people from tweeting however much they want. They want people to use the platform as much as possible. They're just trying to, like I said, get those people out that that have been posting quite dangerous messages and forwarding things that incite violence, you know,
or terrorism, you know, right, April?
Upskirt photos, yes, terrorism.
Right, because I've certainly,
you know,
ISIS,
so they've also taken,
right?
A lot of action on that.
Yeah, I know. At one point, ISIS was using and still is using Twitter as a recruitment tool. I know another part of the guidelines is that if you're threatening or promoting terrorism, that's another reason to be taken off the platform. Jason, I wanted to just
ISIS and the alt-right, yes.
Yeah.
We
just have about a minute or two left. So I just wanted to just ask you about the fact that I wonder if the new rules have caused even more controversy in Europe, especially in the UK and Germany, because of how European laws actually differ when it comes to hate speech versus American laws.
Sure. So you might ask, why is Twitter acting now? And one reason, I think, is some domestic developments, Charlottesville and the march there, focusing attention on racial harassment and anti-Semitism. But then the sort of Harvey Weinstein episode, domestically focusing greater attention on how even speech can be a form of harassment, particularly targeted at women. But outside of the domestic context, you have these global forces, and as you mentioned, in Europe, there are much more restrictive laws about what can be said, much greater capacity on part of the government to punish certain kinds of hateful or offensive speech. And in Europe, in Germany, a requirement that Twitter act within 24 hours to remove speech that is in violation of German law, including various kinds of hateful and offensive speech. In the future, some possibility that the European Court of Justice, which has just taken a new case out of Austria, might rule that not only must Twitter respond when it's told about something offensive or hateful, but it actually has an affirmative obligation to hunt down, to monitor what's going on and what's said. That puts a company like Twitter in a bit of a bind because it can, you know, it can try to just sort of tailor the site, what is seen to the German context, or it can just start taking stuff down globally, which is technically easier and cheaper. And so I think, you know, that sort of external pressure from outside of the United States might help explain some of the convergence that we have in this country with respect to how Twitter is operating. You could sort of have a kind of single standard across the board that complies with the stricter European requirements. And I think we're going to see more influence externally from particularly Europe, and in ways that really are not consistent with traditional First Amendment values, but that tap into the domestic cultural developments, as I said, Charlottesville, Harvey Weinstein in particular.
That's Jason Mazzoni. He teaches constitutional theory, history, and law at the University of Illinois. I want to thank April Glazer as well. She's a technology journalist for Slate. April's written a lot about this. We'll tweet out on Twitter some of her pieces that she has done on this. April, thanks for being with me. Jason, thanks for being with me as well. I appreciate it.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the 21st, we're going to be speaking with an astrophysicist from Northwestern University who was recently awarded the Danny Heinemann Prize for Astrophysics. Vicky Calagaro joins me next on the 21st. You're listening to The 21st, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. When two black holes collide, they create ripples in space and time known as gravitational waves. It sounds like the stuff of science fiction, but for a team of researchers led by Vicky Calagaro, it's the real thing. Vicky is a professor of physics and astronomy at Northwestern University. She directs its Center for Interdisciplinary Exploration and Research in Physics, and she was recently awarded the Danny Heinemann Prize for Astrophysics. She's on the line now from Evanston. Vicky, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks. Thanks for the invitation.
And congratulations on the award. For us lay people, can you explain? Is this like the Oscars of physics, the Heinemann Prize?
Oh, I don't know. We don't get to walk on the red carpet.
So this, you work with black holes. And before we get started into what the awards committee said about what you did, I wonder if you can explain for us, what do we know about how black holes actually form?
So what we understand about black holes is that big picture, we know of two types of black holes. Black holes that form from stars, like our sun, except if we want to form a black hole, they have to be more massive. So our sun has a mass of one times the mass of our sun. If we want to get a black hole eventually, we need to have a star that's about 10 times or 20 times the mass of our sun. And when that kind of star completely consumes the nuclear fuel in its center, then it cannot resist its own gravity anymore, and it ends up collapsing. And the gravity wins all together and brings the whole star into a single point. And that, at the end, the mass collapsing into a single point, basically forms what we understand to be a black hole, per Einstein's predictions a century ago.
And
go ahead.
Well, yeah. I was going to ask where gravitational waves come in then.
So gravitational waves are also predictions of Einstein's theory from a century ago. And what Einstein understood when he developed his theory of general relativity is that when masses are moving and are being accelerated in space, they can actually disturb space and time, but it's easier to just think of space. And when masses are moving very rapidly, then they can jiggle space and generate waves, and the waves can propagate at the speed of light, the same way light, regular electromagnetic waves, light that our eyes can see, propagate. Now, when black holes are forming in this collapse, then gravitational waves can be generated because the formation is very violent and matter collapses at very high speed. But at the same time, there is another way of generating gravitational waves. If you manage to get two black holes that have already formed, but then the black holes are can find themselves in orbit one around the other, just like the Earth is going around the sun, if you imagine now two black holes going one around the other, the two black holes eventually can come closer and closer to one another. If they collide, then they are disturbing the space-time extremely intensely, and they generate gravitational waves.
So what is
it?
These
waves that we have observed.
Okay. What does it mean, though, to disturb space and time?
So
is that too complex to explain?
It is. It is a little bit. But it's easy to understand if we think about it in the following way. So think of an undisturbed lake that is very flat. The surface of the lake is very flat and undisturbed. If we throw a stone onto that lake, then, of course, the surface of the lake is disturbed, right? The stone falls in, it goes into the bottom of the lake, and then ripples at the surface of the lake are being created as circles, and they propagate at the surface. So when two black holes are moving one around the other, when the collision happens between the two black holes, then the biggest disturbance occurring in space-time, just like at the moment of the stone touching the surface of the lake, you get the biggest disturbance. And the gravitational waves are exactly causing a similar disturbance. The space at the moment of the collision is being disturbed in a very similar way as the surface of the lake. So you get these ripples, but now the ripples are not happening on the surface of the lake. They're happening actually in space. So space is being stretched and squeezed just like the surface of the lake in my example.
Vicki, how did you first become interested in all of this? How did you end up studying astrophysics?
So you may notice I have a subtle accent in my speaking, and I grew up in Greece, and I liked math as a student in high school, and I discovered physics in high school, and I pursued physics in my undergraduate studies. While as a college student in Greece, I discovered astronomy by taking a course, and I came across readings about compact objects like black holes, and I learned about what they are and what we understood at the time, and I got exposed through, again, courses and readings to the possibility of doing research on black holes as an undergraduate student already. And I decided that this was something I could not resist. I had an opportunity to pursue research outside of Greece, and eventually I came to the U.S. to do my graduate studies. And I can't explain why exactly I wanted to do this, but I really, it was like falling in love. And since then, I've been studying black holes, and eventually I've had the opportunity to live through this amazing discovery of gravitational waves that for a century since Einstein's prediction, we've been trying to detect, and we finally, through a big collaboration of people, we managed to achieve.
I want to ask you about that because I know we spoke with two members of your team about this last summer. But first, I just wanted to go back to your education for a minute because I read that your mother didn't receive more than an elementary school education because her dad didn't think that girls should be educated. But your father was kind of the opposite of that, wasn't he?
Yes, actually, I'm not sure where you found it, but it is true. My parents grew up through the Second World War in Greece, and then we had the Civil War. So they didn't have the opportunity to go through higher education. My mother was told by her father that elementary school education was perfectly enough for girls. And so after elementary school, she was told that even high school was too much. And she was absorbed in high school household activities, etc. My father finished high school, top of his high school, always wanted to pursue math, but instead he needed to basically support the family after the war, and he went into finding a job and earning resources for the family. When I was a girl, even though my father was extremely conservative, when it came to education, he was convinced that education meant opportunities for a better life. And he was very conservative when it came to my upbringing. He had definitely different behavior for me compared to my older brother. But for education, it was definitely something that he thought should be equal between boys and girls. And he never stopped encouraging me. I liked math, and he thought it was perfectly fine for a girl to pursue a math and physics career. And that certainly had an impact on me.
Well, because I imagine when you were first starting out in the field, there were probably not very many other women who were studying astrophysics.
No, I didn't know of any woman who studied astrophysics. I went into undergraduate studies in Greece, and all my professors were male. And the funny thing in retrospect, I must admit, is that it didn't even impress me at the time. It was all so normal that all the professors were guys. I wasn't even conscious of it because this was the environment. And yet it didn't occur to me that maybe this was not for me. It didn't stop me or gave me pause. So there was something very attractive about astrophysics.
Well, and I imagine now, as we're speaking with Vicky Calogero, who's a professor of physics and astronomy at Northwestern University, for your students, are you seeing a lot more women in your classrooms?
Yes, we definitely have a lot more women in the classrooms, but more importantly, we have a lot more women in professor positions. Challenges, of course, continue to exist. At Northwestern, I have been very fortunate. I've loved my career. The university have enabled for me to advance. I pursued all the opportunities I wanted to pursue. But even with all the support, the reality remains. I have been at Northwestern for, 17 years. And the next female astrophysicist after me was hired 1 year ago. So that tells you something about, not about Northwestern or specifically our group, but it just tells you something about the overall community of science and astrophysics and how difficult it is. So there's a long way ahead of us. We keep improving, but we're not there yet.
Can I get back to the science for a minute, into the gravitational waves you mentioned, because this was a huge discovery that happened just for the third time ever. And we spoke with two of the members of your team about LIGO, that's the instrument that's being used to help detect these gravitational waves. What have you learned so far about the gravitational waves that were detected?
Yes, so a number of very exciting things. So first of all, the ability to detect gravitational waves is a whole new way of doing astronomy. So all of astronomy for four centuries since Galileo has been based on detecting electromagnetic waves. And this is regular light that our eyes can see and all the other types of waves we often hear about, X-rays and gamma rays and microwaves and infrared, that detectors that were developed for astronomy are now being used for all kinds of applications in our everyday life, from medicine to defense purposes, microwaves in our kitchens, etc. Gravitational waves is another type of messenger that is being delivered by astrophysics cosmic sources that we knew existed, but we had no way of detecting. So just the ability of detecting it is equivalent to the first time of Galileo turning his telescope and observing Jupiter for the first time. So we're opening a new way of doing astronomy and studying the cosmos. So we're very excited about just this amazing new capability, because we know we're going to discover new things that we haven't imagined in the same way that has happened for electromagnetic astronomy. With a few discoveries we have achieved just in the past couple of years with this new instrument, LIGO, we have already found out that black holes a lot more massive than we ever knew exist. We call them heavy black holes. They are 30 and 40 times the mass of our sun. It's a bit of a puzzle for how exactly they form. Questions of formation is exactly what I study. There were some hints in computer simulations that maybe there is a way of forming them. And the fact that we have now found them in gravitational waves and had not seen them in electromagnetic waves was a bit of a surprise. And we're trying to understand through gravitational waves how this happens in nature.
Wow. So thank you so much for explaining that to us. And I will look forward to hearing more about the research that all of you, that astrophysicists across the country, but in particular in Evanston and at Northwestern University, are working on. Vicky Calogero, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That does it for us today. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information on past shows, how to follow us on Facebook or Twitter. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email. Just head to 21stshow.org. We're produced by Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.